Hi. We're Mediengruppe Bitnik. This is Doma. My name is Carmen. We're really happy to be here. Thanks for having us. And we'd like to show you a series of works. We don't quite know how many. We've been kind of changing the slides, so we'll have to see what fits. I think just two words about Mediengruppe Bitnik. We're from Zurich originally. We're based in Berlin, now have been based for 1.5 years. And we work on the digital, but usually our works also affect physical spaces, as you'll see in a minute. And we'd like to talk about recent works around bots, remote code, glitch. Yeah? So the first work is called Random Darknet Chopper. We produced this work in 2014 together with Kunsthalle St. Gallen. This was after the Snowden revelations in 2013, where we kind of felt that as artists we needed to reassess our cultural Heimat, the internet, you know, as a kind of it was this mass surveillance thing, and we kind of felt we couldn't work there anymore, or that many of our works were too naive. And so together with Kunsthalle St. Gallen, which is an art space in Switzerland, we put together a show around darknet, because we felt that by looking at internet subculture, we could kind of question ideas around anonymity, intimacy, identity, trust. And in this show, we had 12 works by various artists around these topics. And our work was Random Darknet Chopper.
Basically, the Random Darknet Chopper is a piece of software, is a small bot, which we started in autumn 2014. We started with the interest in the question of trust. How do you gain trust in encrypted networks where you don't know to whom you're speaking to? How does those trust mechanism work when everything is kind of obfuscated and encrypted? And we wanted to challenge this question basically on the darknet markets, which were just like kind of a big topic, a controversial topic after the Silk Road raid. And we thought that it might be good to evaluate these questions with a bot, questioning also how does like trust building work when you have goods which are shipped from all over the world to the buyers. And so we wrote this bot, which was called the Random Darknet Chopper, which had $100 weekly budget based in Bitcoins. And the idea was that the bot would log in into the deep webs and go to the biggest darknet market at that time. It was called Agora, I think. And randomly select an item and then buy it and directly send it to the exhibition space without our kind of interference. So the idea was that in the exhibition we had like 12 of those vitrines. They were empty, basically waited to be filled over the 12 weeks of the duration of the exhibition.
So we basically connected the very dark markets of the darknet with the very visible space of the art gallery.
Technically it was pretty simple. It was basically a small Python script which remote controlled Firefox and basically logged in to the darknet market through Tor, and then just like clicked around to choose like a random category, get all the items below $100, randomly choose one, hit the buy button, send an encrypted message to the seller to send it directly to the exhibition space and pay the fee or the things in Bitcoins.
So Over time, we wanted to have a whole landscape of goods from the darknet. There was also a lot of talk in the media at the time, well, there still is, about, you know, the darknet and what you can buy there. And we kind of didn't believe, you know, what they were telling us. We really wanted to see what we would like randomly, like a random selection, what we would randomly get from the darknet. And the first item was called Fire Brigade Master Key Set, which the seller said was a set of keys usually owned by the Fire Brigade in the UK to open storage.
Public gates in public space, stuff they need access to. So
we have no idea whether it's true or not.
But I still really like that object because it has that potential of, you know, opening doors in the UK.
The second item was cigarettes from the Ukraine. So basically, you know, in very good darknet fashion, circumventing the taxation on tobacco in the European Union.
I think it was about $35 at that time. Third week, we had like this Louis Vuitton Trevi handbag for $95. And actually, if we speak about trust, this was the only item which wasn't delivered. But the seller was kind enough to send the bitcoins back because he knew like he couldn't deliver. So also here, it kind of worked.
Then we received the Lord of the Rings collection by J.R.R. Tolkien in PDF format, which for $1, which we printed.
Yeah, it's like several thousand pages. Then the first, like, or no, the second, like, super digital item, it was called the Visa
Platinum Top Card, sent from Torland for $35. Apparently, this was a Visa prepaid. We received a Visa, so the Visa number, the expiry date, the name, and the little number you have on the back.
Yeah, and we didn't dare to use it.
Then sixth week, the random darknet chopper selected 10 yellow ecstasy pills with a Twitter logo on them, sent from Germany. For $48 to Switzerland, they actually arrived. We took them as a title for the talk also because we really like the description. Displayed them like the rest.
They came like in this stealth packaging, kind of pretending to be a DVD in this alufoil and then vacuumed again.
Yes, and around about this time, also the press started picking up on the work because they kind of felt that this random darknet chopper was questioning or posing questions around, you know, who's responsible if a bot commits something illegal. What happens when a software bot goes on a darknet shopping spree? The Guardian asked, who is responsible when a bot randomly shops for ecstasy in the darknet? Is it the person who programmed it? Is it the person who executes it? Can a robot or a piece of software be jailed if it commits a crime?
And also, what happens if the code is open source and written by many people? Like if you have like an algorithm which goes wild?
But the random darknet chopper just continued shopping, and it bought some Nike Air GC2 limited edition trainers for $75.
Mm-hmm. If you convert like the bitcoins into nowadays value, it would be around $3,000. It costed $75 at the time.
Then we received a cap with a built-in camera. That's where the camera is. From the US, for $99.
Then a thing I really liked, it's called like the Decoy First Class Letter. So it's basically a plain letter you receive, like a service, and it came from Australia, addressed to like our exhibition space in Switzerland. It's basically an empty letter, just like to basically trace route your postal, to trace route the postal system to check if the system is okay, if you can receive mails, if it's, you know, maybe somebody opens it. So the idea, like, by, you know, buying stuff in the deep webs is basically also to anonymize somehow your postal box. And to test that, you can basically, you know, send yourself a letter and see if something happens. It's also good tactics to basically, if you want to introduce a new address somewhere, you know, start sending letters there. And the post office, the post, like the post person, the delivery person will kind of, you know, get used to it and basically, you know.
Yeah. The next item was a Sprite stash can. You probably know this. This is a soda can, an empty soda can, constructed to weigh the same as a full one, and you can screw the top on. So you can place whatever you want inside, and it's hidden away.
Then the next one, diesel engines, a replica from Hong Kong for $79.
And the last item we received was a high-quality scan of a Hungarian passport for online verification. So here you see, this is basically how we displayed the items. This all went really well until we took down the exhibition in January 2015, and the day after the exhibition closed, the public prosecutor of St. Gallen in Switzerland basically seized the whole work, and we were a bit confused. This was, yeah.
Yeah.
So we were a bit confused in the first moment because of the timing. So after the exhibition closed, they seized the whole work. But it kind of turned out that they were, for them, it was mostly about the drugs the random darknet shopper had bought. We were kind of worried about the passport and the visa card as well, which they felt was totally okay.
Yeah. And in the first moment, I mean, like, you know, the question also by the public prosecutor was raised. I mean, like, it was about responsibility. Who's responsible in this specific moment? Is it the artist who wrote the codes? Is it the museum who basically hosts the show? Is it the curator? Is it the people who work there? Because, I mean, like, me and Carmen, we've never touched those drugs. We've not. Basically, you know, it was all done somehow automatically. Or, is it the bot himself who is somehow its own legal entity and could be punished? So in order to somehow also protect the staff of the museum and to also, you know, to get our items back, we thought, I mean, like, this stuff is ours. We want the things back. We raised our hands and said, no, I'm like, I think if you should... If you want to charge somebody, you should charge us.
And we were summoned for an interrogation, which was really interesting. There we learned that the drugs actually contained MDMA. So the police had tested them and confirmed that they did.
I mean, like, we knew through the ratings on the drugs, on the darknet markets, that, I mean, like, this stuff was good.
But then we... We kind of had to discuss, you know, or we kind of tried to explain what we were, that we were trying to raise these questions in public through public, you know, publicly accessible art piece, because we felt it very important that we talk about these things. Nevertheless, the public prosecutor decided to destroy the drugs, which was very unfortunate. We, of course, claimed they were an art piece.
So you're destroying an art piece here? And our lawyer was also kind of, you know, referencing all other artworks which involve drugs, like from like the whole history.
Yeah. But we did receive the whole work back in the end, except for the drugs, and all charges were dropped against us. And the public prosecutor wrote a very nice letter saying that we actually were allowed to break certain laws to raise certain questions within society, without specifically naming freedom of art.
Yeah. So basically our understanding of why they kind of seized the whole thing is that they were kind of afraid what the next artist would do. So the first one, you know, buys it, the second one takes it as a performative act, and the third one gives it to the audience, you know, and it's kind of clear that they need to draw a line.
So, yes.
So the question about responsibility was not kind of solved.
No, we
here.
Still have, yeah. So we kind of then continued with this question of bots and the mechanical gaze. Oh,
yeah,
okay, you're jumping, sorry. Yeah. Wrong introduction. A year later, the same year, we were asked to do a public art piece, which is always the case in Switzerland when public buildings are built. Part of the money has to go into an art piece, and usually that art piece is sculptural. It can be a sculpture in the lobby or
a sculpture in public space. There's like different kind of things you need to address. The public art piece should work for 30 years, should be sustainable, so it's mostly made out of stone.
Yeah. So for us as digital artists, this was a very kind of an interesting question, also because the building was or is the House for Electronic Arts in Basel, also Switzerland. So for us the question was, how can we talk about digital topics, but not using digital media.
Mm-hmm. And we ask ourselves, is there a way of? I mean, like we thought a lot about architecture and software and how basically the software you use is also infecting,
or yes,
the architecture which is built. And since this is all software, what we have never seen is basically a software error, kind of. You know, so we ask ourselves, is it possible to build, or is it funny to build like a software error into stone? And
we kind of had to try that.
Yeah, we had to try that. So we took a picture of the place of this house and basically glitched it through a small script and told them to rebuild it. And this is how it looks now.
This is what the building looks like today. So basically you can see it. They and it kind of when you stand there, it kind of gives you a surreal feeling to, there's a like a square in front of this facade, and you're kind of not sure whether, you know, your eyes are wrong or the building is wrong. And then when you come closer, you then of course see.
And also like built. You know, also here, like the glitch reveals stuff. Like, you know, people came to us and asked, I mean, like how does the piping system work? You know, I mean, like, is it still here? And this is something, you know, which we like about software glitches, that you kind of, sometimes you get an understanding how system works only by kind of breaking it or by forcing it to throw arrows. And yeah.
Then we.
Sorry. Yeah, we need to discuss what we're speaking about. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So okay.
Yeah.
So we'll skip another project because we're running out of time.
I think the last piece we'd like to just quickly show you is very recent. We're still kind of amazed at this. So this year we were asked to do a book on our work, and we kind of felt this was really difficult for us, because usually we do websites and you can change websites, and then you do a book and you kind of, it's printed and then it's there, and that really, it was very, very kind of hard for us. But once we decided to do this, we kept thinking about how can we break this very static print format of the book. And together with the two designers of the book, Konrad Renner and Christoph Knort, we thought about, you know, we said, well, the title should be code, because maybe through the title you could kind of inject code into various websites, because books, you know, they're online, you can buy them online. And we decided to go for script alert Mediengruppe Bitnik script.
Is, yeah, just like a stupid
as a title.
JavaScript, basically, which normally, like, you can't write JavaScript into a commentary field on Facebook, because this thing is parsed out. And so the browser does not execute that code, so they check it. But we thought, maybe, I mean, like, if it's so deep in the databases, like the ISBN databases, the national bibliographies, and whatever, you know, it might pop up somewhere.
And so the... and... Well, the book came out in September, and then in October we realized that on Walter Koenig, which is a big art bookseller with a big online website, it worked. So when you search for Mediengruppe Bitnik on the website, hope this works, and you go to the catalog, you get that.
So this one is pretty okay. I mean, like, normally if you, on other website it breaks the buy button, which is like not in our interest, but So yeah, you can still buy it on Buchhandlung Walter Koenig. Just like click okay and then it's okay. So yeah, here's just like a small collection of like 10, 12, which are popping up. It's like every day we get more. And yeah, and we can show you a small video like of two, three pieces.
Yeah. Don't know what we're gonna see now. I think eBay.
Oh, they're gone.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is eBay.
So, eBay.co.uk. Bam. And this only worked on, or they already fixed it, so somebody made a bug report. I like this one.
So.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Already people line out. Yeah, please. Number two.
Very cool talk, thanks. I'm from Switzerland, so I wonder, you were lucky that you got dropped with the charges. How much would you got for the charges if you would not drop them? Do you know?
I don't know. I mean, like, it was basically, or here it was about drug possession, and I mean, like 10 ecstasy pills, and we were totally okay to take this fine. We don't know it, but it was kind of...
It would have been a fine because in Switzerland, according to our lawyer, it would have been for personal use. I mean, this is not the amount you carry around, apparently, if you're selling. So we would have gotten away with a fine.
So, and I thanks very much that you said that actually writing the code and then the program buys it, makes you actually responsible, right? So would you, also you, at the end you said like, it was your, also I would take the charge because you were writing the code,
yes.
So.
Yeah, the problem was that usually, at least in Swiss law, possession of drugs needs to mean that the drugs were either found on your person or in a space that can be, you know, that definitely belongs to you. And the problem was that it was clear from the process that we hadn't touched the drugs. And we didn't want somebody else to get fined for drug possession. That would have made no sense. We wanted to also publicly discuss this, you know, this having to, step up and say, no, it was us.
Thanks.
Okay, final one.
Hi, sorry, thanks for the talk. I have to ask, does the plumbing work?
Yeah.
it
works because, so the pillars were, I'll try to explain briefly. So architecturally, this building was, storage for dry goods, and the pillars used to support the building, but when they turned it into a museum, they actually filled the space between the pillars with insulation, so the pillars were gone, and then the architects didn't like it, like, you know, they thought the pillars should be there because the building didn't look good, so they actually put fake pillars onto the facade again, and so we could just kind of take the empty pillars and cut them up and put the plumbing inside. So now the visible plumbing is fake, but the real plumbing is inside the pillars. Yeah. That's how it works.
Amazing work, one. Yeah, one final big round of applause for Mingo Pobitnik, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.